Hey Chris, how's it going?
It's well. It's early. It's dark. I'm tired. All of the above.
I feel the same as you, and but I'm proud that we were able to hit record this week only after speaking for like 2 minutes off air.
Boom.
So we're working towards your goal.
We'll say the inbox zero goal.
Oh, there. Okay, that's cool. And it never lasts long.
I know it doesn't. Something always comes in or comes up. So, yeah, that's cool. I like to and it's just it's a thought experiment, a podcast experiment. Believe me, I love the chat regardless. But I was thinking afterwards about what you said, that the quicker that we sort of pass through some of that rapport stuff, maybe that would be too mechanical. Might be a little bit too cold. Definitely won't give me enough chance to get, 5 or 6 sips in my bigger cup of coffee this morning before we get into the mess.
Well, let's see what happens with the way we progress. Because maybe, and I know you said, or at least I think I remember you saying something like, those few minutes before we hit record, you don't mind doing that type of thing when the record button's on. But my perspective is there are some things I'm not going to share when the record button is on. So let's see what kind of flow we get from this. Because it might change and it might not. Who knows, right?
That's true.
I have been thinking about something all week, though. I felt like last week I hijacked our talk because before we spoke on the podcast last week, you had texted me, or we had texted back and forth about what we were going to talk about, and we didn't even touch what you had suggested because we ended up talking. Last week was also the week that I took very little notes. But like the big deals for last week were, in my opinion, from my perspective, talking about the taking the best from other disciplines, being aware, thinking critically, resilience and anti-fragility leading to lifelong learning. So that was not, well, maybe it does connect with kind of what you wanted to talk about, but so I thought this week I'm just going to stay quiet, throw that down and see what you do with it.
It's I think that's at its heart one of the fundamental differences between the kind of the way things go with I'll say the podcast that I do away from this month, my other podcast, is that I feel kind of obligated to create a plan for those podcasts. I think only in so much as when I'm asking somebody that I'm not as deep in the relationship as I am with you, and I ask them to come on and chat, I don't know. Sometimes I feel I'm guessing on their behalf that they feel more comfortable because I'm presenting, here's the possible frame that we're gonna chat in. And it creates, I guess, a safe kind of scope to have the conversation. Now, I'll say that often within that, we wander around, and there's been some guests on that podcast that turn the microphone back on me, and it ended up being more them asking me questions about stuff. So but still, I think going into those, I'm a little more mentally structured as far as where it could go. And that's usually also based on the fact that I've lurked their profiles, or I've read an article that they've written, or I've seen a project that they've developed. So that's kind of piqued my interest, and I want to chase that one down and see, what the impact of their existence is on education. So that frame kind of exists. I find with you and I, some of those provocations or collisions that we mess with throughout the week is a little bit like that 2 minute on ramp that we've shortened. It's like we're volleying the ball back and forth a little bit, and I don't feel too off by not making it to it, because there's a certain amount of when we get chatting where we're chasing stuff that pops up between us. So I didn't feel at all that it was hijacked. I loved talking about that because it was still, somewhere between what inspires me singularly throughout the week. I've come to appreciate that that can take second place to what you and I start talking about. And maybe that's the human element. That's definitely the human element of what you and I are doing with this side hustle, that we're allowing that opportunity to say, okay, that's kind of interesting. And it's funny, because I think that in a lot of ways, so that whole thing about me wanting to talk about future teacher last week, I think in many ways we paralleled that by what we were talking about. So we kind of addressed a side hustle to future teacher when we're talking about, you know, resiliency and being kind of like you said the anti-fragility, that sort of, when we said that, what's the difference between being resilient and anti-fragile? I think that is one of the elements of teaching, and definitely one of the tools of moving forward as a teacher. So yeah, I didn't feel too put off at all. I think part of it is also there needs to be almost that imposition of self when you and I talk. So, you know, even if I lead something and I'm talking about it, I for you to say, yeah, I get it, that's cool, this is what it made me think about, but it's a asymmetrical balance. It doesn't have to be, I get 3 minutes, you get 3 minutes, and then I get 3 minutes, and then you get 3 minutes. Far less measured. So I still think that we hit a flow last week that felt natural to me.
Okay, that's cool. I just took a picture on my phone. As you were talking, I could see your reflection off of your microphone. Mm-hmm. And so I captured, you probably can't see it well, but I captured you doing your thing, reflecting off your mic. It's kind of cool.
Reflections.
I like it.
There we go. The reflective practice in a microphone. Yeah, that high chrome. I almost got one. They had actually several colors. The one they had green and red as well.
And I like that one.
I think it's, well, yeah, it's funny. I think, I don't know what it is about it. It feels a little bit Terminator-esque for some reason, just the high polished chrome look. And on this side of it, this is what I have constantly staring at me. So I'll just point it. There's the red eye.
Yes.
So it's just a little bit like a little Terminator-esque with all that chrome and the red eye staring at me the whole time.
I just keep thinking it's classic. It's got that classic look. Mm. But when you showed me that red eye, that's future teacher right there.
There we go. It's so
Did you want to talk about that? Did you want to like put it down and see what we do with that?
Yeah, sure. I think last week my thought process was going towards future teaching, and I wish I could find it. I put out a tweet, I don't know, it was about maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was talking about the major collisions in education, and it was sort of like a top 10 list. And a few people took a bite at it and said, yeah, number 5 was mine or number 8 was mine. But I've lost the tweet. And I think that's what started me thinking about future teaching. Some of the things on the list are part of my constant fascination in education. And without being able to do the list justice, it had items on there about students, not only, I think the transition right now, let's say when we talk about students, one of the things, student voice, but it's no longer student voice where the teacher needs to be the amplifier. The students are actually the voice, and teachers take sidecar to the students. There was definitely a global education part on the list there where we're no longer pursuing what it means to be globally connected. We accept that it is, and we exist in that space. I think there was something also in there about using technology. And I kind of took that as we're no longer using technology as this accelerator. Again, it's the normal where technology exists in multi-forms in the classroom. And there was a few people from my Twitter PLN chiming in and saying, yeah, I'm working on this one. Do you remember which one you ticked off? Do you remember the tweet that I sent out?
Sorry, I had you muted. I had me muted. I found it. As you were talking about it, I went and found the article because I actually posted it. Our school board has a G+ page for staff to, like, you know, share things like that. And I just went and found it. So I'll tell you which one I don't remember if I told you the one that I really liked or the one that was bothering me, but I think that was a great article, by the way.
Could you bump it back over to me? Are you, if you see it there, could you just shove it back to my Twitter feed so I could put a heads up on it?
I will do that. I'm just going to, I'm going to be selfish here for a second, and I can't even see. Anyway, yeah, I can send it back to your Twitter. So the 10 disruptions that will revolutionize education was what it was called. And you
know, it's funny.
Go ahead.
No, it's just, it's, I think what's, there's, I get this strange feel. Okay, so first off, it wasn't, I had to force myself to read that list. The only reason is that idea of disruptions, the word hack, and other, and revolutionize modern learning. Some of these buzzwords have started to lose some of their punch for me. I get positivity when I hear it. I get, hey, take notice. I get a little bit of that electricity that kind of happens around it. But I find I notice it less and less. I think the reason that I noticed this particular list was not because of the titling on it, but was because of who shared it originally. So it was the person that someone that I respect in my Twitter sphere that I thought, okay, if they found it, you know what, I'm going to give it a moment to read it over. I'm going to give some time to it and see if it gets in. And then I saw the title on it. I'm like, oh, another one of these titles about revolutionizing education. But you know what? I pushed past that. That's a whole other episode of chat. But I sort of pushed past it and I read it and I thought, okay, I think what I appreciated in it is that the article isn't very long. There's not a lot of prelude to it. It's a short intro to 10 things that I believe would be great thought fuel for PD sessions. I think it they're good provocations. Thanks, man. I see it just popped up. Great provocations. And I also think that if anything, maybe it serves as a leap off point to what we have to accept as being where we are. Like we no longer get to, I think it's getting harder and harder to say that some of the things are being suggested here. This isn't the future of education. This is like where we are now. And I'm starting to fall away from me and my duty to surprise staff by what the, not the future of education, but what we're not paying attention to is the now of education. And I think you and I had this conversation as a sidebar one time. I've definitely had it a couple of times on my podcast, where what's considered to be revolutionary, if people get too swept up in it, then it makes it seem as if they could never do it, because they're saying, oh, that's so far off. That's future. Oh, you know, you're using Google Hangouts in your classroom. Oh, that's just too far off for me. And I've kind of changed my perspective in having those conversations from, I can teach you how to use it, as opposed to like trying to get someone on board by giving them the step-by-step on how they can include it in their pedagogy, and kind of shifted more towards just talking about it like it's the water we swim in all the time now. And it doesn't have to be through me. If you just, you know, step out in the hall and start walking down the hallway, you're going to see more and more individuals using it. So yeah, I liked the article, but yeah, the 10 disruptions that will revolutionize education. That's a titillating title. I'm glad it doesn't spend too much time trying to convince me that we need to revolutionize education per se. And it jumps right into what to me looks like stuff that is cracking off right now in education. What are you thinking?
Well, a couple of things pop into mind based on what you've said in the article and the perspective in it. So the first thing that really hits me is that, okay, well, the first one, digital learners will rebel against intellectual conformity. Here's the thing. When you were saying that, you know, people are like, whoa, this is whatever this is, it's so far down the road, I can't do this, you know, I don't have the capacity to do this or whatever. I thought to myself, the only times I feel that way about anything is when it just doesn't call my name, when it has nothing to do with me, I'm not interested. And so I'm not going to make it happen. But when something really, I don't know, when something really connects with me and my approach with my students or with something I want to teach my kids, I will work at that and I will get at that no matter what it is to make sure it happens. And I have evidence that I've done that before. So I don't just, I only sit back and say, well, that's not going to happen, or I don't see that happening, mostly because it doesn't speak to me. When something does speak to me, then I go after it. Now, some of the things that, you know, we want to do or the direction we want to move in, some of the things we don't really have control over. Like when we talk about the use of technology in the classroom, and, you know, everybody has an IT department and IT manages that whole structure, that hierarchy. And so sometimes without IT's approval or without IT's mapping of the system, there are things that we cannot do just because it's not built in place for us to do. But I mean, there's always workarounds, right? Like if you really want to have a hangout and your school board doesn't allow for that on the main system, there's a workaround. You can find a way to do hangouts in your classroom without using any of the school board's equipment, right? Like, and I don't know about you, but I've been there. There's a ton of stuff in my room that nobody's approved, but it's there and I use it. I leverage it as much as I can. Times have changed though, right? Like times have changed. There's all kinds of things in the classrooms now that in my school board that weren't there before. So that was the first thing that came to mind. The second thing was looking at this list. I remember telling you, well, some of it is kind of advanced. Like to me, number five, capacities will matter more than grades. Well, I mean, talking to a grade four student at my school, okay, that might make sense. But talking to a grade 12 student who's trying to get into university, they might not agree. You know, they might be like, I don't care what capacity I have. That math grade needs to be over 85 or I'm not getting in. And I need that to happen. So I think, you know, the kids that are in grade four now that might feel that capacities will matter more by the time they get to grade 12, if the system has shifted, in a way, then maybe that will ring true, but maybe it won't, because if universities and colleges are still operating the way they're operating now, then you still need those grades. Like, I mean, ultimately, if you are self-actualized individual, then sure, who cares about grades, right? Who cares about what someone judges you in terms of where you're at academically, because you know within yourself that you've built great capacity ultimately. But I mean, who's there, right? Like who's there? If I have a TPA this week, a performance appraisal, and I walk into my principal's office, I'm like, yeah, my capacity's off the chart. And she says, yeah, but you have no day plans on your desk. And, you know, you ignore this and you ignore that. And that's what is on my list here that I need to kind of talk to you about. I need to check it off. Well, I'm in trouble, right? Like, so I think things like that are things to work towards, but there's still a wall that's in front of people. And that wall is going to require a lot of work to be moved or brought down, in my opinion. Teachers will become inventors. I think that has always been the case. Like as far as I can think back in my educational experience, I've always run into teachers who have, I want to say created things. The word invent is a strong word for me, but they have done what they've needed to do to take the kids where they needed to go in one way or another. So I think that's always kind of been there, but I really like that. Teachers will become inventors. School leaders giving up their desks. I've not seen that yet, but that's an easy one, right? Like that's a really easy thing to do. We should ask Rodenizer about that one and see if he could just give up his desk, because he seems to be moving in this direction, right? I'd love to hear his thoughts on that. The one that really hit me in terms of feeling like it just wasn't happening was number 8, students and families will become co-learners and co-creators. There's something about that one that just doesn't, it just doesn't spark anything in me. And I think I'll tell you why. There are some families that operate this way. I had a great discussion with my class this week about, for example, eating meals with your family. How often does that happen at your home? And I was surprised at how many students said that they don't eat with their family at home. And then they explained why, like there's a lot of action in the house, or it's a single parent home. And so there are other priorities, like in order to survive. But then I thought of this. Students and families will become co-learners and co-creators. And I thought, I'm not seeing that, because they're, in my opinion, from what I'm seeing based on my experience, it's not common for families and students to operate this way. Maybe that'll change, but it's not been common. It's been the novelty. So every year when I connect with a family or two that do operate this way, they are co-learners, they are co-creators, they do share what's happening at home around this stuff with me and my classroom community, it's a novelty. And I don't know what your experience is, and I don't know what others is, but when I read number 8, I felt like it sounds so simple, it sounds so doable, but I'm not seeing it at all. That's what came to my mind.
It's funny, because when I read the article, I tried myself not to get swept up in future education and looked specifically at the things that were going on around me. I think to the activity that that Hurley put us through, where we were establishing what the signals, so sort of what's the change, but what are the signals right now of change? And, you know, by sort of saying that there are things being seeded right now that ultimately could end in a transformation in education, I've come to appreciate kind of tethering myself to those signals right now, as opposed to, you know, sort of leaning out the window a little bit too much into the wind and looking to the horizon, just appreciating that the wind is happening right now, you know, just, and what are the things that are happening in education right now that ultimately will get something, let's say, radical or interesting happening in school. So that this article, as I started to read it, I anchored myself specifically in my context, the context that I have lived through in 13 years of teaching. So is there the possibility that the things that the article is suggesting are on the horizon? Are they already here? What's the actual distance between the two? So kind of like what you're identifying, that this is sort of an interesting concept, but it's a from ground zero suggestion. And then you start to create, well, that's, you know, here's a whole bunch of things that would have to happen in between us arriving at that outcome, because I haven't even seen that looked at right now. So that number 5, the capacity is more than grades. I was challenged by that, but I love the fact that you tie it to being a teacher, you know, because I think in a lot of ways, capacity works regardless, no matter who the learner is. Because I look at capacity as output. And if you are going into your TPA, so your professional appraisal, regardless of the amount of paper you have, which is one of the components that they would be looking for, your method of organization, a very large component is that paper translates into something actual in the real world, which is that lesson in the classroom. I found from my experience with the TPA, there's a whole lot of kind of checkboxy chatter around what your binders look like. But there's a whole lot of robust discussion around what your classroom looks like and how you interact in that space. So I think that that's already in some ways leveraged towards the capacity of being a teacher and existing in front of students and being a teacher or a co-learner. So I see number five kind of existing. That's the seed point that I see right now. And then I look at number five as a little bit more of a starting point, and then moving on to number nine on the list, which is formal credentials will no longer be the holy grail. And that's a really, that's a really fun conversation to be in with individuals that hang their hat on a credit system where the value of that credit, and to a degree then the value of that mark, is what adds up to success. And I was in some really great conversations this past week on Twitter around that, and the terminology of the credit-based system and what is the value of that credit, and why do we use sort of banking language to talk about or economic language to talk about learning, and are we comfortable with that, and how might we rejig someone said, I think it was maybe Jen Apgar said that, you know, well, it's a rebrand, and I'm always cautious of rebranding, because sometimes rebranding still carries the philosophy with it. Sometimes you just need to drive backwards, back that road, and take a different route altogether. Now, I'm not, that is a lot more future to me when we're sort of looking at formal credits no longer being the holy grail, because that automatically opens up other conversations around sort of micro qualifications and micro credentialing. So, you know, you arrive as a teacher with your experience from outside the class. How much of that will you be accredited with even before you go to teacher's college? It opens up the question. This is what it opens up for me. At any point, you know, is it possible to say that faculties of education are not the major landing point to become a teacher? It opens up another question that if a student arrives in grade nine and they've been on sports teams, high performance sports teams, would we give them a grade nine phys ed credit? So that, you know, the let's say institutionalized credits or the ones that are achieved under someone who's a trained teacher, when we start to sort of play with the idea that in-school credits are no longer the holy grail, it opens up a really fascinating conversation. The number seven that you called out, you know, talking about, maybe even talking to Derek Rodenizer about this, the question that comes to mind for me is what would it look like to be, so that's the school leaders will give up their desk. Now, this is, I think, a physical and a metaphorical statement. So it talks about our learning spaces, or what, let's say, what school leaders have as their learning spaces. But I think it goes back to even what you and I were talking about a couple episodes back about getting up off your mental couch. So what does it look like? What does it look like to you in your practice to no longer have a specific desk space? Now, whether or not that is, you know, in a room, like a closed office room, or in a classroom, it strikes me as, how do you become mobile? So how do you get up off that couch and become mobile within your learning spaces? I myself, when I moved into the program that I'm in right now, I got rid of all the teacher desks in there. I just asked the caretakers to take it away. What I have is a kind of a rolly cart with my technology on it, and I'm sitting at the desks with the kids. Or we have a couple yoga ball chairs, I'll just roll that up beside them. I'm kind of leaning beside them. I'm sort of modeling your learning goes with you. You don't have to come to that learning space. Of course, I am limited, as in we only have the two classrooms. So we've never gone to the point where learning specifically goes out into the halls, which is another great conversation, or learning goes out into the playing field, which is another amazing conversation, you know, tapping Aviva Dunziger on the shoulder here, like capturing that out of doors learning, Tanya Murray, out of doors learning. I just like to question, and I can remember asking this before I left my former school, two different things. I put out to a couple people, where would you like to teach today? And, you know, I had a science teacher look at me like, oh, it's going to be in my lab, obviously. I was like, okay, it's not obvious to me, but I think it's a good question. Or the counterspin to that is that if you couldn't teach it in your classroom, where would you like to teach your course? So in the process of giving up our spaces, one thing I would like to see, and I don't know how it would work, but what if there was a high school I'll take high school because it's my context, where the administrators didn't have a dedicated office to work out of. What would that existence look like? And I'm being a very specific school leader. There's a lot of different leaders. But in the conversation around, one of the things that has happened in the past, we talked about this last week, is there are individuals that like to have their classroom space and to be able to stay in that classroom space for a long amount of time. So their learning space becomes them. They are the learning space. The students are part of that little community. I think probably administrators have the luxury of having their own learning space pretty much for the duration that they're at the school that they're at. They get their office. They get their spot. And everyone comes into that spot usually primarily by invitation, but more, you know, some can drop by, sure, but they have the luxury of developing that space and sort of recreating that space in their image to a degree. But what would that look like if an administrator no longer had a dedicated office? What would that do to their job? And sorry, finally, that makes me, and Rod Neiser may be able to speak to that. Maybe we could sort of provoke him into trying to give up his office for a week and ask him just to, we should, eh? Let's do that. Let's ask him, see if he'll do it. I'll do it. I'll push it to him. And that just makes me land finally on the number six. I think number six, I think the inventors, you're right, powerful word. I'm not a fan of that idea of the inventors. I think if I had to put a word there, I think it's probably makers, because that, let's take the trendy word right now. I think that makers, I guess you could put creators. Heck, we could be probably, I could be more provocative in that by saying teachers are become comfortable with being makers and creators. And the seeds that I see for that right now, it's funny, because how many teachers do you know that have packaged and sold their own material? That's a long list, man. And it's coming along. Like it's easy to find educators that are kind of marketing and selling the stuff that they are creating. So I think that the seeds are happening right now with that change. There's a whole lot of educators that are more than willing to create and make and send their sort of material out to others. Some are selling it to other teachers, and there's teachers that are buying those type of materials. I think that the idea of having maker spaces in schools will maybe, and the more sort of spread out that would be, like if you have maker spaces, not just in your classrooms, but in spaces where every learner could walk by and just see it. Maybe it's in the hallways, maybe it's in the front foyer. It becomes a little bit more embedded in the way that we do school. Maybe more educators will be comfortable with showing what their creative side is. But the invention, I don't know. Invention kind of strikes that it's an original idea. I think there's, you know, it falls back to that revolutionizing education. I don't know if the inventors is what's as necessary as people that are just willing to kind of create and make and kind of give away. That was a whole lot, man. Sorry, I wrote down, I'd unpack a couple connectors there for you. What are you thinking?
You did throw down a lot of good stuff.
I know.
No, it's good. I like the practicality of trying to get Derek Rodenizer to give up his desk for a week just to see. It would be really cool to hear about the process of that. Like, here's the thing. So right away I started thinking, oh, well, what would I do about this? Or what if I had to do this? Where would I go to do that? Like, there would be a lot of new learning happening, which is pretty cool. And I think someone like Derek, who is open to different things, I think, you know, he'd probably keep a list like, oh, I need to make a personal phone call to a parent, and this is what I had to do, or this is how I ended up doing it. Like, there would be a lot of troubleshooting. And I think that, you know, someone knowing that going into it, that would be good, right? You'd know there's going to be a lot of troubleshooting here. So anyway, I'd like to see how that progresses, if at all. But you're going to hit him up with that, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, what might be kind of cool. You know what? The dude posts. So it's not like if this catches his interest, I have no doubt that some of the work that he'll do is he'll throw down an episode, which, you know, we could hear firsthand how this played out. So yeah, I'll approach him and ask him whether or not he'll give it a try, give it a ride, and then we can do a little bit of a follow-up next week just to see. I like that idea that you said about, again, the logistics of it. But every time I start to look about logistics, I create the two lists. Is this about me or about the other? So that having to have that private phone call, and if automatically, and I added private, but let's say I need to have that phone call where I don't want a lot of ears or eyes around me, I don't know necessarily how many of the just because statements can I strip from the justification of having an office to do my work. So for example, if you have to make a private phone call, well, to me, that's just a phone that is not in plain sight. It's a phone that's not in plain sight of everybody. That could be anywhere, really, right? You could go into a classroom that's not being used during that period and just close the door behind you and use one of the phones on the wall. Or you could walk back to the other side of the school, into your office, close your door, and kind of go there. So I like the idea of logistics and just evaluating, are the logistics because I've always done it that way, or are they real criteria that I need in order to fulfill this task?
It makes me think of a teacher at my school who gave up her desk. There, now, this isn't new. I've come across many teachers who have given up their desks over the years, but recently a teacher at my school gave up her desk, and what she has in place of her desk is a rolly cart, this little rolly cart with all these compartments, and that's where all her like equipment is, and it just follows her around, right? So it's definitely doable, right? Like I said, it's a logistics thing. Like, for example, where will I keep my day book? You know, all the things that you use your desk for now, you either have to eliminate those spaces in your room or find a new space in your room to take over for the space that you're going to lose, at least in my mind. So for example, what's stopping me from giving up my desk is that everything that's on my desk or in my desk right now, in my mind, that's where it belongs. So I don't even really sit at my desk. I sit at the table where the computer is, because we're constantly engaged in digital content or digital creation. And that's the home pad. That's where I control, you know, the digital. You know, attendance is online. There's all morning announcements are online. So I need to be, that is my new desk. So when I say to my kids, oh, can you put that paper on my desk? They're like, which one? Yeah. I say, what do you mean? And they're like, well, the computer table where you conference with us, where you write notes to our parents, where we do the Google Hangouts, where the Brightlinks is connected to, like this long list of reasons why that should be my desk, as opposed to the table in the back of the room where my day book is, where my code is, where my resources are. So, you know, it's definitely doable. I'm excited to hear what Derek says. And like you said, knowing Derek, he'll probably create a podcast around it if he were to pursue it, or even a podcast about why he wouldn't pursue it. You know, that's where he's at. But that list is a great launching pad for any discussion. Like, you and I have been talking about it for a while now, and there's so much there. And I do appreciate the fact that they didn't drone on and on at the beginning, that they just kind of dove into it.
The last thing I'll throw down on it, because I had written down number 8 on here, and you had mentioned about the community, and I guess parents, and I guess it's basically the community being co-creators in the classroom. Having the families as a part of the learning process, I can remember, so before I left, I staff meetings are very different now because my team is a lot smaller, but being in my former school where some of these ideas that I have about education, I was able to kind of extend them into, you know, a staff of 70 teachers, there was a whole lot more varied voices and reactions to some of the things I said. And often when I was sitting in these spaces, I found because of my context, so I was in alt ed, so working, my portfolio in some ways was how and what I taught was similar in my previous school as it is to now. There's things that are added to my context currently that make it very different, but I found I was able to bring my teacher side to my new context and then learn the new tools that I needed to have. So when I go back to my previous context, often as I would be sitting in PD sessions and listening to some of the challenges of change that other instructors had or the challenges with their context, it wasn't my context. I had a difficult time sometimes connecting with some of the challenges of behavior, the challenges of connecting with families, because it was sort of stuff that myself and my team, we did very naturally. So we sort of inverted that some of those challenges and say, well, we get to those things first. So we don't start talking about credit acquisition and then talk about the difficulty of managing behavior. We flip it and we say, what about, we talked about the challenges of making relationships and connecting and then kind of pushing outside of that, whether or not that led to kids' success. Could be measured by credits, but we would just say we looked at the wellness first. So number eight, one of the questions that I asked, and it was coming up around TPA season, and there was always some sort of a conversation with the whole staff talking about, you know, whether some rules of engagement had changed or the list is going to be coming out soon. And I can remember being at a table conversation asking my colleagues, because there's one of the things in the TPA process, and I don't know if it's the same for you and I, but there is one of the look fors in our TPA process about how you're including, it's the language of it, I believe, is closer to how are you including parent responses in your practice. I forget the language, but it basically is how you're using community voice to inform your teaching. I'm not doing the language justice, but that's the flow. So I put it to the table. I said, so what would it look like to include parents in your lesson planning? And it was like I set off a bug bomb. No one wanted to touch it. That idea of having someone from outside of the classroom make decisions about how you teach your class was a really, really kind of explosive little statement. I never got any legs on it, but the question has stuck with me. And this was 3 or 4 years ago. And now we sit here looking at this list where someone smarter than me or more publicized than me is sort of kind of putting that forward. Is like, how do we include? Because we're getting really comfortable with the idea of including other classrooms from around the world in our planning. You know, we look to anyone who's cracking off on global goals or doing expeditions or mystery hangouts. And there are instructors that get it. They're like, yeah, you know what? We're going to, yourself, you did that book talk that you were doing, was it with Pete Cameron? So you're co-learning. And in doing so, you're saying that this other community is an integral part of my lesson planning. But you get to this weird kind of uncomfort zone where you say that you're going to extend that exact same planning or activity building when we talk about parents. And I never got any legs on that when I put it to the team that was sitting at the table with me. I was like, how would you include parents in your lesson planning? And they're like, what do you mean? Like asking them what I should teach? I'm like, okay, there's one. What do you mean? Like having them come in and help? I'm like, okay, there's another one. But kind of playing with that where they feel automatically included. They're not an add-on. So that was my last little bit there about number eight.
No problem. You got me thinking about TPA a few years ago. So I, 3 years ago, I was on performance appraisal and I systematically went through all of the, I don't know if you want to call them expectations or just the points on teacher performance. And one of them, you're right, was around, I don't know if it said parents, but I remember it was about using the community to help the learning in the classroom. And so my go-to example for how I engage in that was Google Hangouts with a variety of different people that I bring into my room to help my kids with the content and with making connections to experiences in life. And what I started doing was in my newsletter every month, I would invite the parents to contact me if they felt that they had something they could offer the class. And the way I wrapped it around was the way that I got to it was around career paths. So there's also something in the TPA document about exposing students to a variety of careers, of paths in life. And so basically my newsletter says, parents, this is one of the things that I'm trying to do with the kids. I'm trying to help them see that there's a lot of different vocations out there. And so if you would like to come in and talk about your work, what you do and how you got there, you're more than welcome. Connect with me, let me know, and we'll make it happen. I've been doing that for 3.5 years now, and I've only ever gotten two parents that actually connected with me and said, hey, this is what I do. I think it's kind of boring, but you put it out there and I would love to help. And I've said, you know, let's not judge. Like, you're going to hit kids in the room that think your job is fantastic. And that's what I need them to, that's what I need them to experience. I need them to see there's more to life than just police officers, teachers, and firefighters and school principals. Like, there's a ton of things out there and they need to be exposed. So I did, one parent actually came in and talked to my kids, and one parent, we did a hangout because they couldn't make it in. So I said, well, let's just do it virtually. Like, I'll bring you into the room. You can talk about your work. And it was great. But 3.5 years, and I'm not getting any bites with that. Mm-hmm. And the second thing I wanted to say about that is there are some expectations that are a little bit out there. And it makes me laugh because by far, I do not meet all the expectations. And you always have something to work on. But one of them has something to do with being part of provincial committees, which for many teachers is just way out there for them, right? But I've actually been fortunate enough to participate in provincial level activities. I wouldn't call them committees, but I would call them activities, initiatives. And I remember talking to my principal 3.5 years ago about that. And, you know, he mentioned that it was the first time he had ever done a TPA with a teacher that could meet that expectation. So even some of those expectations are a little bit ridiculous. Like to say to a teacher, hey, you know what? You should consider getting involved at a district level, perhaps the provincial level. Those are good goals. Those are good for your PD. If they meet the needs of what it is you want to learn or what it is you want to be involved with. But to actually have it listed as an expectation that, you know, teachers under this umbrella of whatever competency are participating in provincial level committees, I think some of those things need to be revisited, just because, come on, like we're all in the room, we're all planning lessons, and we're all improving our understanding of curriculum and content. That's our bread and butter. But to push people into an area that, you know, somebody could use against them in an evaluation, I don't think that's right. And I'm really going off track here, but I just wanted to throw it out there that I remember reviewing every single one of those and then comparing my practice to those expectations, because I needed to be aware. And like I said, there are lots of things that I wasn't doing, but then I started rolling those things into my practice in different places in manageable ways to be able to have that conversation and say, yeah, looking at these expectations under this competency area, you know, these three things that are just suggestions, I don't do any of those things. And so how can I begin doing those things? And then it gave me an awareness of the things I'm not doing and why I might not be doing them. And then how can I change some of that so I can start meeting those things? Because if that's what the province wants me to be, then I will attempt to move in that direction so I can meet the requirements of what a teacher does in Ontario.
It's true. I get that sometimes. I totally get that sometimes looking at TPA and performance appraisals can feel like all of a sudden you're put on blast, where you sometimes start with, well, I didn't really know that that was something that I should have already been doing. And it's suggested by the fact that this you're presented with this list of look fors, and you sort of stare at it and you go, okay, but what does that even mean? Like, my context is so all consuming that I can't even see how that would be a part, let's say, future education here, future classroom. Like, I can't even see how that's part of me being a future teacher. I thought that was sort of somewhere off as I developed my craft, but I'm, you know, they're using this kind of standard checklist as in, this is what I should be doing. I found the chunk in the performance appraisal. I think there's an updated version, but the language about that parent input goes something like, new teachers may choose to gather parental and student input and reflect on it as part of their performance appraisals. Experienced teachers are encouraged to gather parent and student input in developing, that's key, reviewing and updating their ALP, so their annual learning plan, each year. So there is the language in the rules of engagement, and that's from a ministry document about performance appraisals, to seek out input from your learners. So that, in some ways, is one of the seeds. It's what is currently expected. The suggestion on the list is that we're going to arrive at somewhere once we embrace that, once we fully sort of engage in that. What that means in the bigger picture, I don't know, because I've had that. I've seen the look on some people's faces like, what do you mean I have to have parents help me with planning? And I'm like, well, maybe it's not that simple, but how are you curating and organizing some of that into your reflective practice? And it definitely, as we get closer and closer, you know, as individuals, we're constantly connected. What does that look collectively when we look to our school communities to be constantly connected? And are we sort of leveraging that? And we can say constantly connected and, you know, people say, well, that must mean that you're talking about technology. Well, no, it can be human as well. You know, do parents come and sit in your classroom when you teach? Are you, we've talked about this, are you sitting at hockey practice where your students are playing? That's constantly connected too. That's the community building element. And the idea that it's only digital or only in real life maybe is what's keeping us from going to education 3.0, is that we're still creating that line between, like, somehow who we are in the classroom is fundamentally different than who we are in the community. And parents maybe are thinking the same thing. I'm a parent, but all of a sudden I become something different when I walk into the school. So that could be through technology that we're sort of making that line get closer and closer till there's no more line. But that idea that we're looking for conversation with all of our constituents is, I think, the challenge in there. And, you know, you put that to any educator, like, oh my gosh, that's just such a big thing to manage. I put all my parent emails into student folders in Outlook. Does that qualify as sort of, I'm like, yeah, that, I would say, you know what I mean? Because that is the entry level. But there seems to be some responsiveness or agility that's being suggested by the performance appraisal process. Big challenges. I like them though.
For sure. So is this it for episode 9?
Sure.